welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, where you get me, Becky Friedman, for today. I got Luke in the studio with me. How are you today, Luke?
Doing great. You?
I am doing well. And for the first time in a very long time, Nick, welcome back.
Hi.
Nick, I hear that you have been doing your part, taking a cue from Greta and foregoing the meat recently, at least on one fast food trip, right?
Earlier today, I had a non-meat burger from one of the larger fast food chains.
Ooh, okay. So one of those newly released ones that are supposed to taste exactly like the meat-esque, meat-filled version of the dish, right?
Yes.
What was your verdict?
Spoiler alert, it tasted exactly the same.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that like a vote of confidence for the impossible product, or is that like a criticism of what a fast food burger tastes like to begin with?
I think right now I want all my meat to be lab grown.
Okay.
So I've been with that for a while.
You want it to be lab grown, not necessarily plant based, or does it matter?
Either one, whichever is better for the environment and whichever one doesn't cost me $78 for a meal.
Okay. All right.
The lab grown meat's great.
You've had the lab grown?
Well, I mean, it's a great idea.
Okay, great idea. I'm wondering how we can get it down to something that is less energy intensive than, you know, like growing a cow, you know, like an actual organism, a full breathing, cud chewing, methane producing cow, right? Like, I know that that's really energy intensive. From everything that I see right now, the lab grown meats are also kind of energy intensive, right?
They've reduced it dramatically recently. It's still a process. It's going to take a little bit of time yet, but I'm looking forward to when I can eat that at a regular restaurant. I'm pretty excited.
I think it's cool. Now, in terms of like the plant-based meat substitutes, I feel like there's kind of two different categories of folks that enjoy eating meat but are also willing to eat plant-based things. And those that really enjoy eating things like seitan or texturized vegetable protein formed into patties to imitate a chicken nugget or a hamburger or something like that. And then there's those of us that say vegetables are wonderful on their own. Why don't we, like, you know, saute up mushrooms and onions together and put them on a big, you know, inside a pita with a lot of roasted red peppers and enjoy vegetables for the wonderful things that they are and what they bring. Where do you guys fall on this?
Why not have your burger and eat it too?
Okay.
My mouth is watering right now. That all of that sounds delicious to me. I prefer, honestly, as far as burgers go, I like a black bean patty.
Okay.
Just yummy.
Over an actual burger.
Over an actual burger, yeah.
Interesting. I really liked when we started looking at portobello mushroom caps. Put some vinegar and grill it as you would a burger and put it between two buns, but not try and think of it as a burger substitute, just a sandwich on its own.
It's something different, but still good.
Yeah.
Powerful, tasty.
Yes.
And I think that there's this really interesting sort of balance going on or phenomenon going on where you have folks that really want their cheap fast food burgers and are willing to go to such lengths to say, you know, die Greta in little bumper stickers on their big SUVs that, you know, chug lots of gas and everything. And then at the same time say, I want to be in line for the impossible burger, right? And it seems like you have to bring yourself to a place where you're insulting a 16-year-old girl who's just literally begging adults to let them be kids and let them grow up into adults and at the same time be first in line for something that's fashionable. Like, have you seen this confluence of seemingly contradictory behaviors?
Is that actually a thing now? They're people rolling coals to get an impossible burger?
When you looked at the big drive-through lines when these kinds of, you know, when it first came out and it said, oh, the Impossible Burger is sold out and we 36 hours, no locations have them anymore. Look at what's in line. Now, I didn't actually see the ones that are insulting Greta Thunberg and other youth environmental activists in line for the Impossible Burger, but it seems like that there is this confluence of those two kinds of things. But at the same time, maybe the guys that are saying, like, I love rolling coal to, you know, choke 16-year-old kids, blah, 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 are really wedded to their actual animal barbecue meat.
Yeah.
I think it might just be people following the crowd and trying something new and something that, oh my gosh, does this actually taste like? Yeah, it does. It does.
There is some novelty in that of seeing, hey, can we get it to taste like the thing that I want it to taste like? Like, that's an interesting thing.
It's great. The idea of trying to create a burger that isn't a burger but tastes like a burger and is indistinguishable from a burger, that's a fantastic feat of engineering.
I think it is a fantastic feat of engineering. And it brings me to the concept of engineering is one of the things that we, through our human ingenuity, can utilize in order to reverse and improve a lot of the environmental damage that we've done so far. But at the same time, it is not a panacea. I am not thinking that all of this, engineering feats are going to be the deus ex machina, the literal machina ex machina, right? That will help preserve, access to resources and to usable clean water and things like that. I think there's going to be a lot of working together on the part of religious people and non-religious people, on the parts of people of differing governmental views and political spectrums and people of different economic perspectives to really recognize that we do need to do something that is less individual and much more, socially dependent. And for that reason, it alarms me every time I hear Donald Trump saying things like the strength is in national identity and we are not globalists and globalists are the enemies. I mean, it's something that, and I'm sorry to bring up Donald Trump, and we won't be talking too much about all of the amazing things that seem to be going on in Donald Trump's life this week too much. But do you guys hear that kind of talk from him and sort of the echo that resounds in the strength within national identity? I mean, do you hear that? Does it alarm you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it definitely bothers. It's one of the things that, honestly, at this point in my life, terrifies me. So, and that on top of that, you've got the fantastic dog whistle of globalists.
There have been folks that have been saying, hey, if you are a globalist, and that's contrasted with nationalists, and when nationalism is so linked to a Christian white identity, as we've talked about on Ask an Atheist, then globalists would be the enemy of a Christian nationalist identity. And so we see a lot of folks saying, hey, this is a dog whistle for anti-Semitism, or this is a dog whistle for anti-miscegenation. And this is a dog whistle for racism against non-white individuals, for indigenous people. And we see that. And I think that there's some merit to that. And I think that those are the things that we need to, as rational thinkers and as rational and logic dedicated consumers of media, those are the things we need to be looking for and listening for when we hear things from media outlets, when we hear things from our elected officials, when we hear things from vocal activists, any kind of leader. Those are the kinds of things that are worrying to me. I don't know that I go to the point of being terrified. Why do you use the word terrified, Luke?
I see a couple of paths this country could go down right now, and one of them's pretty decent. I like it. The others are continuing the way we're going or diving straight into that whole nationalist white male Christian identity that I find to be incredibly destructive and distasteful.
Nick, what about you? Are these kinds of things that are on your mind when you're listening to the news, when you're going about your daily life?
Yes, and it makes me nervous and scared a lot of the time. It's the kind of mentality of someone who is willing to knock down their neighbor's house just to make their yard a little bit bigger. And that is not what I want my country to be.
So there are some of those things that we're kind of on the cusp of, but at the same time, we have little glimmers of hope, little glimmers of social justice here and there at the levels of municipalities, at state levels. We have people that are clearly dedicated to working towards repair, towards social safety nets, that are looking towards environmental preservation, things like that. And to that end, we've got a story from Maryland where a federal judge has dismissed the lawsuit of a man who wanted to practice so-called gay conversion therapy after his state had banned it for minors as part of Maryland's Youth Mental Health Protection Act. U.S. District Judge Jeborah Chazanov granted the state's request to throw out the legal challenge that self-identified ex-gay counselor Christopher Doyle had presented. Doyle, with the help of the right-wing religious group the Liberty Council, argued that the ban on conversion therapy for minors violates his rights to free speech and religious practice. Judge Chazanov stated that the First Amendment does not provide absolute protection to engage in religiously motivated conduct, especially in the case of harm to children. Maryland is one of 20 states and territories that restrict conversion therapy in some form.
This is great. One of the things that gives me hope that we're going to head in a good direction, you can practice your religion, but you can't force it on children.
You can't force it on children in ways that are documented through rigorous scientific
right.
studies and medical consensus to do active harm to children that are not yours.
Right.
There's these little steps, right? Because if this Mr. Doyle or Counselor Doyle, who believes himself to be formerly gay, formerly suffering from same-sex attraction, happens to get married and procreate and have a child, like, he can still do that through his own parenting.
Which is terrible, but
he can't do it under a business model. He can't do it as part of his professional conduct. And the real weird, interesting thing here is that it's not saying that, hey, you've lost your suit. It's saying, no, this is not even a suit that we can even hear. I've dismissed it. Because Maryland has the authority to govern professional conduct in the case of businesses. And she's saying, this isn't about free speech. You can still speak what you want, but not as part of your business. And he's like, well, my business is all about speaking to my clients. And she's like, yeah, in the context of being a therapist, the talk, the speech is what the professional conduct is. And that is the thing that can be regulated. So no standing. I find it interesting, and these kinds of legal arguments really fascinate me. I don't think that we've heard the end of this kind of, you know, protest. As long as the Liberty Council exists, they're going to be looking for aggrieved, aggrieved Christians that don't believe that homosexuality is a thing that's, you know, natural or inherent to someone's, you know, right to identify or things like that. And we're going to keep seeing these, but it surprised me when we kind of looked at it. We said, hey, there's 20 states. Well, there's 18 states plus D.C. and Puerto Rico that say, no, you can't do this for minors. And some states that say, no, you can't do it at all. My favorite was Connecticut that said you can't do this because it's under our business law, because yeah. it's fraud. It amounts to fraud. What were your guys' thoughts when you sort of looked at this and looked at the map of all the places that have banned this conversion therapy?
It's much smaller. There are far fewer states than I would have expected at this point. And the fact that Washington just outlawed it last year is a little disappointing, but it's changing. And that particular idea is gaining traction around the country, just not in the South, except for Florida.
Yeah, talk about Florida a little bit, because it was it kind of looked like a little chicken pox thing when we looked at the map of places that had banned this so-called gay conversion therapy.
Florida is a weird. I've been there once. I don't know much beyond that. The cities are generally nice, but as soon as you move outside, it especially as you move north, it gets a little more rural.
I think one of our favorite things on Ask an Atheist was, in the very early days of the show, we had one of our listeners that said, the further north you go in Florida, the further south you are.
Yes,
that is yeah. exactly true.
So what did we see when we looked at Florida and where things had been outlawed?
Municipalities, cities, towns, not the state itself.
So if someone is in West Palm Beach, they can't go to a counselor in order to have your 14-year-old, who you believe is gender nonconforming and has demons, you can't bring them and pay a counselor to counsel them in ways that negate that child's identity. But step outside West Palm
right.
Beach.
You could drag them off in a van into the woods.
You know, you say that as if it's something that doesn't happen.
It does happen.
It absolutely does happen. And we see lots of these kinds of therapeutic reparative schools, so-called therapeutic, so-called reparative schools that bounce from one state to another when they get outlawed, when, you know, Michigan says, no doing this. This is harmful for kids. Those same folks go to someplace like Ohio or Florida, or maybe Florida cracks down on them, so they end up in Montana. And then Montana says, no, I don't like this so much. And they bounce over to Idaho. And it's something that, as folks that not only are irreligious like we are, but as folks that are concerned with the welfare of minor children, you know, those are another one of the things that we want to look out for. I'm still stuck at this. I'm a counselor and I am an ex-gay person, and I'm going to counsel other people to be to be not gay. And it's just one of those things that you say, this is still a mindset that persists. And it's one of those things that is a little bit, I don't know, baffling to me.
It's kind of like the way that religious schools used to dissuade children from writing with their left hand.
Oh, not even just religious schools, but schools in general. But it was, yes, definitely a thing within parochial schools.
Yes.
It sounds like you have some kind of familiarity with that. I know one of my teachers was made to write with her right hand.
I know a few people that had older people that had to learn how to write with their right hands because they got smacked when they used their left hand. This was just regular public school.
And to think that these are the kinds of things that we have moved beyond gives me some hope and some good hope that things like gay conversion therapy for children are some of the things that we also can move beyond. You are listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. We'll be back after the break. In the meantime, hey, feel free to give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I love our polka theme, written by one of our listeners. And the reason I think I love the polka theme is because it gives an air of ridiculosity to things. And, well, ridiculousness is what I've got coming up next for you guys. You ready?
Go.
I guess I am.
It's been a little while since we've entered the fruit basket of Ray Comfort. And I don't mean this in any derogatory way whatsoever, other than the fact that Ray Comfort seems to believe that he can keep going and returning to his supermarket produce section in order to prove the existence of his God. Because in a new video clip released by the ardent creationist Ray Comfort, the preacher is hailing the existence of the orange as evidence for God. He states that oranges, like bananas, have been made with a non-slip surface, just the right size and shape to fit the human hand, with each fruit filled with natural sugars, vitamins, minerals, and enzymes. Comfort also suggests in the same video clip that atheists don't even know the so-called right way to open the fruit, demonstrating a citrus prep technique commonly taught in culinary training programs. Genetic phylogeny shows that all modern citrus varieties came from a common ancestor 15 million years ago that underwent three major waves of evolutionary change. Now, okay, I know that it's been a while since we all looked at Banana Man Ray Comfort, right? But for those of us that maybe are a little bit, I don't know, have either blocked that out of our mind or never even heard of, I don't know, atheism in the mid-2000s or creationism in the mid-2000s, can you guys give me a little rundown of the Banana Man argument?
Oh, there was the banana is like perfectly made to hold, to fit in the human hand by God, and it comes with its own wrapper, and it's, you know, full of all kinds of vitamins and minerals, and it's super easy to eat.
Okay. Anything else? Any other highlights?
Even when you hold it, it points towards your mouth.
Oh, yeah. That's the funniest one. You see clips of him, and he's like, just has his mouth agape and has a banana pointed directly at it.
Can't you hold it in a direction that points away from your mouth with similar comfort levels?
I don't know.
He should know. It's in his name.
So, Ray was discomforted and disquieted by the knowledge that the modern banana actually, within recorded human history, has been something that's been engineered, like the Cavendish and things like that. Like, that is a triploid fruit that, yeah, you know, was specifically domesticated and bred within recorded human history. And there's, even if you believed in God having created the world, you would still find it inconsistent to see that the banana is something that is not created 6,000 years ago,
right,
but, you know, within our recorded human history.
The modern banana can't breed by itself. Yeah. They're all clones of each other, which is why they keep dying off.
Well, sort of like corn, you know, corn needs help to breed at this point.
Right.
It's, you know, from a little grass that the native Mesoamericans were able to domesticate and then cultivate.
Make into its awesome form today.
Yeah, I mean, but now he's gone onto the orange, okay? No, there's a lot of things that can fit in the human hand, maybe because our hands have, you know, evolve to be very dexterous, and we can grab onto lots of things, we can make tools. But of course, no, according to Ray Comfort, that's all things that, you know, God has provided. But there's a few things that I want to dig into here. So the non-slip surface, okay? I don't know if you've ever had to, like, do major food prep for large groups of people, but any round items, like when you're carrying a big bunch of them, like, they don't fit well in your hands and they will slip and roll. Like, that's just a thing that happens, right? I mean, I have got tons of apples in my kitchen right now waiting to be pressed into cider. Those are round. Oranges are round. They are not non-slip. No way, no how.
As soon as they get wet, they really get slippery, especially if there's juice all over them. That's not easy to hold on to a bunch of those.
Yeah, try to carry more than three at a time and tell me that they're easy.
The packed with amazing things like natural sugars and vitamins and minerals and enzymes, there's oranges that the amount of sugar that's in them is definitely not naturally occurring. They have been cultivated and domesticated and bred over a series of generations to have really high sugar contents to be palatable to the market, right?
There's a reason we grow them and not lots of pomelos.
Oh, yeah. Those are those huge grapefruity things with, like, the really big rinds, right? I like the pomelos. There's something, like, really kind of interesting and cool about them. I feel like I almost feel like they need, like, a set of eyes on them to become a Sesame Street Muppet or something.
Or what about the Buddha's hand? It's a type of citrus fruit that doesn't really have any flesh. It's just essentially pith and skin, and it's largely decorative, and it's not supposed to be eaten.
The Buddha's hands are amazing. That weird citron that does really have, it looks like digits coming at you. Maybe the orange fits perfectly within the Buddha's hand.
Within the Buddha's hand.
I've never seen one of these. I'm going to have to look it up now.
Oh, they're great. It kind of looks like looks like a citron, but if you just made them into, like, six or eight or four or five digits kind of coming out of the area.
If you made it look like Cthulhu.
It's a hand full of bitter and uselessness.
It's decorative.
Right.
Sort of like Ray Comfort. Decorative and full of bitter and useless. No, I don't even think he's bitter. He's, like, remarkably convinced that this is amazing and wonderful. He's gone from banana to orange, and at some point he went astray a little bit, and I think that he was onto this with the coconut, but it took me a little while. Nick, you're a little bit more versed.
He absolutely did that with the coconut. He did the same thing. It's easy to open, which coconuts are not particularly easy to open when you get them straight off of the tree. And if you smash it against this rock, this line appears, and if you look at the three dimples on a coconut and imagine it's a face, and have it face down and smash it along this line just like you would a human head. Wait, did I just say that?
It's like giving us instructions for how to bash in skulls as evidence of God's existence.
Wow.
You're not supposed to think about that.
No. So obviously he's wrong here. The best way to open up a coconut is with a half inch drill bit so you can put a straw in it and some rum.
So Luke likes trepanning his coconut fruits.
I trepan my coconut.
Okay. I gotta say, dashing one's skulls against rocks is very kind of Hebrew scriptures, you know, evidence of God and things like that. So maybe it is evidence for God, you know, for him. But when you come down to it, like, the orange is not a perfect thing. It's not perfectly full of wonderful vitamins and minerals and enzymes and sugars. Like, yeah, there's that. But there's also ones that are, like, really toxic to people.
Yeah.
Have you guys heard of the grapefruit drug interactions?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I have.
So that apparently has some citrus varieties contain what are called furanocoumarins. They're these naturally occurring organic chemical compounds. If you spill that on your skin, or if you are, I don't know, making some kind of, like, poultice that you think should be cool, and let's add some bergamot to it, or let's add some grapefruit seed things to it, or let's do this, and then you put it on your skin, like, and you go out in the sun, it can result in a huge blistering rash. That's the photosensitizing of the skin. That doesn't seem so God-given to me, right?
No. That happened to my youngest brother. He was making margaritas or something down in California, and it was his first year down there, I believe, and he cut up a bunch of limes, juiced them, and then walked outside, and he had huge blisters all over his hands. It was awful.
Oh, did he go to Ray Comfort and say, did Ray Comfort give him a banana to place in his blistered hand?
Oh, well, that would have been
painful. Well, my son.
But even just that, citrus fruits are incredibly acidic, and it's going to cause damage if you consume them in a large variety. If he was going to choose the perfect fruit that was God made for us, perhaps it would be something that you could eat more than a couple of without having a stomach ache.
Oh, I don't know. I'm like a total like just fruit garbage disposal. I mean, in the summertime with all the berries, I just become one with the black bears.
Berries.
Yeah. I mean, just like any kind of thing. So I'm good. I could eat lots and lots and lots of fruits. But hey, not with any of the various medications that I would have to be on, because this Furano coumarin is also the thing that interacts with medication. So if you ingest it, you're not going to break out in blisters and things like that. But it'll interact with lots of different drugs, and so that's why a lot of doctors have said no grapefruit, but also limes and sour oranges and bergamot and things like that. You're not supposed to consume when you are on certain kind of drugs.
But MAOIs were created by man, not God. What is more important, eating your oranges or, well, living a long, happy, productive, healthy life?
I
like being healthy.
Apparently, Ray Comfort wants you to be healthy, but only by an orange's standard. You know, and the interesting thing when we look at oranges, like there's a lot of things that are called oranges, a lot of things that are citrus fruits. And there are sour oranges and sweet oranges. And the sweet oranges that we have now on the market, they're hybrids between mandarins and pomelos. Like, you can trace them to exactly what they were, and you can recreate an orange by crossing a mandarin and a pomelo to make an orange. Like, I don't know why the fact that man can create oranges gives Ray Comfort the idea, so they must have been created by God. Like, why can't man just have been the creator of these hybrids? Like, these were naturally occurring hybrids, and then humans can then work our own ingenuity and engineering to make these things happen.
Right, like the navel orange can't grow naturally. We have to graft it.
What's with the navel orange? I mean, besides that, it's like the little orange in an orange, and they look like they have a belly button on the
They're
outside.
Sterile. They can't reproduce on their own.
Oh, that's the case with a lot of hybrids and grafted kind of fruits, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Just like the banana.
Oh, just like the banana.
Yeah.
But not the coconut. The coconut is the exemplar of be fruitful and multiply. So we've, you know, all of this talk of creationism, it reminded me of a question that we have. This is Lindsay from the internet who asks, while I understand that human beings use our planet's resources to create all sorts of things. Good. You're ahead of Ray Comfort, Lindsay. I have never seen a human being create an entire planet. So if you and I are way smarter than a rock, yet still lack the ability to create a planet, why do atheists and scientists believe that a rock has the ability to create a planet? Gentlemen?
We don't.
Oh, we don't. Done.
Nope.
That's it, Lindsay.
No, the whole question kind of brings up the total lack of understanding of how the universe works, which was what science has been working on for, you know, the past several hundred years.
Or how the mind of an atheist or scientist works. Like, to ascribe that these are the thoughts of an atheist or these are the thoughts of scientists, that we believe that rocks created planets. Like, we're not thinking that there's a rock monster that, like, you know, from Galaxy Quest gets up and takes humanoid form and then goes to their clay potter's wheel, right?
No. Over time, due to gravitational accretion, the planets formed into spheres and eventually we came to exist on them.
Okay. So, rock did not create a planet.
No. Gravity. Mm. Gravity did that.
Gravity. Oh, is gravity God?
But what created gravity?
We don't know.
We don't know, and that's the cool thing, Lindsay. As atheists and as scientifically minded people, we're okay sometimes with saying we don't know or we don't know yet.
Let's find out.
Yeah.
That's the wonderful thing
about
it.
We're trying. We're definitely trying. Now, this whole idea is, you know, we used to try to find ways of discovering how things happen, how the earth was created, and, you know, that's where religion came in. Eventually, we developed the scientific method, and we just kind of proved all those ideas wrong.
And looked at the earth wasn't necessarily and inherently created by anyone. The earth came into formation through a series of processes, or the orange hybrid came into existence through a series of naturally occurring processes. You know, and I wouldn't even have such a quarrel with folks that said, you know, all these naturally occurring processes, I believe that God guides them. Fine. You know what? We probably agree on way more than we disagree on. Just because you think that maybe God guides these processes, I probably have like a lot of common cause with you. You probably are also in favor of preserving our environment and being kind to one another and things like that. It's just like we don't have a belief that God guides any of these processes, or that anything intelligent or intentional guides these processes.
And abiogenesis is still something that it's in its infancy of us trying to understand it. I don't think that we can, well, recreate it until we fully understand it. And, well, if we continue along the path that we are right now, it's only a matter of time before we completely understand it.
We have actually managed to produce amino acids in an environment similar to what we would have thought would be on a primordial Earth. So there's that, though.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful advancement. Let's continue to find out more.
So not everyone is stuck in this idea that that some being called God created the Earth within 6,000 years. There are some folks that are kind of like recognizing that our ancestors or forebears maybe didn't have the full picture. And for this, I want to bring us over to England, guys. You ready?
Ready.
Oh, yes.
To one of your childhood homelands, right, Nick?
Yeah. I spent about 5 years of my childhood living about 70 miles north of London in Cambridgeshire.
Okay,
that's
well,
awesome.
We're not going quite there. We're going to Somerset because an English cider maker has revealed a fossil that was hidden by his family for generations because his ancestors feared it would contradict the word of the Bible. Julian Temperley had grown up knowing that an ichthyosaur fossil lay in the garden of a family cottage. But it wasn't until he saw a David Attenborough documentary featuring a similar fossil that he opted to have his family relic professionally cleaned, studied, and displayed. Temperley's great-great-grandfather had unearthed the piece around 1850 during quarry work before Darwin's On the Origin of the Species proposed evolution from a common ancestor. Temperley explained that at the time of its initial discovery, fossils were considered to be the work of Satan. The image of an ichthyosaur, a marine creature of the Jurassic period, will grace Temperley's next batch of 20-year cider brandy.
Delicious.
Oh, delicious ichthyosaur. You don't get to eat the ichthyosaur, Nick.
It's high in minerals, though.
Oh, quel dommage.
We have to do something to temper the high mineral content of the cider brewing that's going. No. There is no ichthyosaur in the brandy. But yeah, the high mineral thing, it was really cool. They said that there was actual enamel that was still in the teeth.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know. Do you guys have like a favorite ancient creature, either dinosaur or one of the marine ichthyosaurs or anything like that? Is there one that you definitely like clung to when you were a kid?
Mine's
going through your dinosaur phase?
Always been the Deinonychus, the big version of the raptor from Jurassic Park.
Ooh. Okay, say it again.
Claw. Deinonychus. I mispronounce these all the time. I'm pretty sure that's how it's pronounced, though.
Okay, all right, cool. And what about you, Nick?
I like trilobites. I think they're cute.
Those are awesome.
Ooh, you can find them all over the place, too. When I was leading a camping trip of seventh graders through the Grand Canyon, one of the amazing things was actually looking at the different rocks and knowing that some of these splotches, when you look closer at them, they're little trilobite fossils and other kind of marine aquatic multicelled organisms that are, when you look closely, see evidence of them right there.
And when you know that it's something that was there from millions upon millions of years ago rather than some kind of test of your faith that was put there by Satan, it's going to spark an interest in the sciences and hopefully right all of the wrongs that have happened.
I can tell you that being there with a lot of seventh graders, there wasn't anyone there that said, nope, that little splotch in the rock was put there by Satan. And I was very glad for that. So you like trilobites. You like the
Deinonychus.
The big scary raptor thing.
Big scary raptor thing.
I always really liked Ankylosaur.
Those are cool.
Because it reminded me of an armadillo and a turtle, but had the mace on the end of its tail. So it's like this really, really hardy little turtle thing. And of course, a lot of my conception of dinosaurs were influenced by, you know, like Fantasia and things like that, that have dinosaurs or other kinds of ancient creatures from completely disparate time periods.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Coexisting. But there was something just like really scrappy and awesome about that little ankylosaur.
It's like an ancient Pokemon.
Yeah, it really is. It's like a little ancient Pokemon. It's totally right. Yeah. But the ichthyosaur is a really interesting kind of creature because they were the ones that ruled the seas. And to think that, in the 1850s, when you just had, I think that Mr. Temperley had said, yeah, your local vicar was not very well educated and you didn't want to have that in full view of things. You wanted to keep that quiet. And did you guys hear about sort of the process of how he came to know that this item was in his family?
I do not know.
So he's you know, growing up, and there's this family cottage in Somerset, and he knows that in the garden there is this thing that they keep buried. You know, I mean, the ancestors from the 1850s pull out this thing from the quarry, and they're like, quick, hide it in the garden. And then generation after generation, you have kids that come and they dig it up and they see it and they say, cool, and then they rebury it. Can you imagine having a real Jurassic fossil in your yard and being able to play paleontologist during your summer break?
And then letting your kids play on with it when you think it's the work of the devil?
I guess so.
I think that makes for a really, really cool family tradition.
I think so, too. I mean, now you can't dig it up any longer from the garden. They said after a few floods in 2013, 2014, they're like, nah, the garden keeps flooding. We really got to, you know, do something real with this. Now the family tradition is you get to have this private collection fossil piece up in your business as part of your family lore and history. So maybe not quite as cool as playing paleontologist during your summer vacation.
And even if someone is just going to the cidery for just a tour or a tasting, they could look at that and say, you know what? That is cool.
Ooh, ask an atheist field trip. No, seriously, I know that we've got listeners over in the UK. If anyone happens to go by the Temperley cidery, catch a glimpse of that ichthyosaur, you know, I don't know, post your selfies with the ichthyosaur, send them to us. I don't know, ship a bottle of brandy over our way. We appreciate a cider. And a cider brandy at that.
Cider brandy is delicious.
And I'm looking for a nostalgia trip.
Oh, well, you can see Nick. Nick will be over there field tripping. You know, I think that one of the amazing things is that we can take the previous misconceptions and fears of our ancestors and then situate them within our modern knowledge and say, you know what? No more are we going to hide this in our yard. You are listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, and we'll be back after the break. And welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I'm just really enjoying talking about childhood things with Nick and Luke. You know, what your favorite dinosaur was, what you did on your summer vacation, where you get to go hiking and see little things like trilobites, what kind of sports you were fans of as a kid or now. You guys sports fans?
Does Dungeons and Dragons count?
Oh, man.
I like minor league baseball.
Okay, yeah. Nick and I are good on the baseball front, right? Mm-hmm. Were either of you or are either of you football fans?
I like watching football at the bar.
I like the strategy of football, but also at the same time, I don't really like people running into each other. Like, can't you play this a little bit nicer?
That's why rugby is actually safer.
Yes, it is.
I'm scared of the kind of like rugby that, like, it's intimidating. There's a lot of like amazing moves and these guys are like huge and bulky.
Right.
But what makes that safer?
Apparently because they don't have all the gear on, they're less likely to slam into somebody with so much force that it causes traumatic brain injury.
I know that the NHL was looking at that also as one of the arguments why they shouldn't have helmets or they shouldn't have face guards and things like that. And I don't know, maybe there's a different attitude amongst rugby players, but I thought at least amongst hockey players it was deemed to be kind of wishful thinking at
With
that.
With all the sticks and flying pucks, I think headgear is probably a good move on that one.
Yeah, the rugby ball is considerably larger and softer and doesn't go nearly as fast as a hockey puck. So,
okay.
I think they should be wearing face masks and helmets.
Well, speaking of face masks and helmets and everything, I got something about football, and we're going to try and get through this as folks that maybe passively enjoy football strategy sometimes in a bar, because I am not a football fan. I didn't grow up really enjoying and liking football. I don't really even know the different rules and strategies, but I know that at least there's, I don't know, like a uniform that different team members wear, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the thing.
So, in terms of that uniform, seems that you gotta stick to the uniform unless you want to get in trouble, because a linebacker for the New Orleans Saints has revealed that he was fined more than $7,000 for wearing a headband that displayed the phrase "Man of God" during last week's matchup against the Seattle Seahawks. DeMario Davis posted a picture of the headband to his Instagram account along with the question, "Should I continue to wear it or nah?" along with hashtag let the people decide, hashtag man of the people, and hashtag man of God. The National Football League fines players for uniform violations that include personal messages. Davis faces a roughly $14,000 fine for any second offense.
This is a good example of free speech meets I'm in a private organization.
Okay, say more.
Well, I mean, he has free speech rights, and wearing that headband in any normal situation, believing in God and all that, is perfectly okay. Until you sign a contract in a private organization that requires you not to wear or display private messages outside of the uniform standards.
Okay, so what if it's like a sweatband that's like under your helmet, or what if like you are... I don't know, like, what if you're a Jewish football player and you want to wear a yarmulke, a skull cap, under your helmet? Like, is that going to infringe on someone's, you know, religious practice and beliefs and things like that?
That's a fun one. I know, so in this particular case, they're only talking about, like, displays of messages. I've never actually seen a football player with a yarmulke on. I'm sure that's a thing that's happened. I don't recall it, though.
I'm not sure that's a thing that's happened, because I know that when I was a kid, we had given to a lot of kids for bar and bat mitzvahs the Book of Jewish Sports Heroes, and it was, like, at least over 100 pages, believe it or not. So, but I don't remember anyone being an NFL player. But you have a good point there. Like, this display of religious messages was like the words that says man of God, rather than an object or a part of like the uniform. Like if you had a Mormon player that wanted to wear certain kind of undergarments, right?
I'm pretty sure they're allowed to wear crosses.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's a thing. I'd have to look that up to be sure. But it's the message that he's providing that violates the rules. I'm not sure if I was the NFL, I would be worried about it myself. But that's their decision, not mine.
What about you, Nick? What do you think?
The NFL is a private organization. They can regulate their dress as much as they want.
Okay. Now, in private organizations and workplaces and private companies, you still have the right to, you know, religious accommodation, that your workplace doesn't unfairly burden you and things like that. Do you think that that's an unfair burden to say, don't wear this headband that says man of God?
There's a difference between wearing a yarmulke or wearing a traditional headdress or a turban or a hijab or anything like that. Versus if I went into work with a brightly colored t-shirt that said Major Powers and the Lo-Fi Symphony is the greatest band ever, and if you disagree, you are terrible.
Is that your religion, Nick?
May I tell you about my Lord and Savior, Nick Powers? But if there's a difference between that, regulating something like that, and regulating something that is more traditional, or like a rosary, or like I said, a yarmulke.
Right. I bet they felt that it crossed the line between showing personal beliefs and proselytizing.
I actually was like, I don't know that I really agree with the NFL, because I also am someone that really hates dress codes and hates enforcing dress codes. But I'm looking at this and saying, you can't have something that has a personal message on it. And to say, hey, no personal message that says man of God, also says no personal message that says everyone who is gay will burn in hell. Like, those are the things that are being prevented from anyone's random sweatbands or t-shirts or things like that when the league says players, no personal messages. And for that reason, I'm falling on the side of NFL league that says no. I mean, this is something that provides a uniform standard, and it identifies you as your team, and I'm kind of okay with this. The part where it gets a little bit funny is I have never seen someone that's been asked not to wear something associated with their faith be so seemingly casual and nonchalant about it, posting to Insta and saying, should I wear it or nah, right? And then saying hashtag let the people decide. It's like, what do you guys make of that?
I think that may be someone's attempt to rally people around him who are willing to fight his fight for him. Of course, I cannot determine someone's motivation without being inside of their head, but I wouldn't be surprised if that is what's going on. Like, this is what I'm going through. Have at them, people.
It's either that or he just doesn't really care that much.
Okay. I think that the thing that suggests to me that he doesn't really care that much is because he says hashtag man of God and hashtag man of the people. And like, man of the people seems to be like a very global outreach, I am with you, humanistic kind of thing, saying I'm connected to everyone. But I can see how it might be, as you said, Nick, saying man of the people, let people fight my fight for me.
But if it really wasn't a big issue with him, he would have just taken it off and just not made any kind of post about it. That's what makes me think that there may be, but obviously, like I said, I cannot tell what his true motivations are.
He might just be trying to get Instagram hits too.
Or just trying to get some fame in the NFL.
Yeah, starting up controversy, doing some PR work.
Yeah, yeah, and the NFL has been pretty strict on what is allowed in the uniform during a game. In fact, a star player on the Seattle Seahawks a few years ago was fined significantly for having shoes with a popular candy logo on it.
Right.
And the NFL is no stranger to folks using religion as a way to draw attention to themselves and their own notoriety, either through social media or traditional media as well. I want to bring us to another kind of example of religious expression in the workplace, because a Muslim woman is suing a Virginia-based marketing firm after the company refused to hire her on account of her request for prayer breaks. Plaintiff Shaheen Indorewala also alleges that a fast-track management hiring official made fun of her headscarf amidst abruptly ending her second interview with the company. The 26-year-old woman had applied for an entry-level management position last fall and asked that she be able to abbreviate her 90-minute lunch break in order to take 2 5-minute prayer breaks. She alleges that the hiring manager then pointed to her hijab and indicated that he didn't want to deal with her religious shenanigans. Company CEO Ramses Gavilondo claimed that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission found no wrongdoing on Fast Track's part during an investigation, and that the reason for Indorewala not being hired was because she wanted to preach her religion. A lot of kind of messy aspects to this one, guys.
So she wanted to practice her religion, and they saw it as preaching her religion.
As far as we're to know from the plaintiff's lawsuit, that apparently she just asked to say, hey, instead of taking my 90-minute lunch break all at once, can I abbreviate that to 80 minutes so that 5 minutes out of this part of the day and 5 minutes out of this part of the day, I can excuse myself to pray because that's, you know, what I'm doing. And to end the interview then, and then to say, no, she just wanted to preach her religion. Merely informing your employer that you are requesting these religious accommodations does not seem to be preaching as far as what I'm looking at. What do you think, Nick?
I think that it is possibly some projecting from the people who are making this decision.
Ooh, what gives you that impression?
I tend to hear those kinds of arguments from people who are very, very quick to tell you about their Lord and Savior, and not necessarily from the people who just want to make sure that their supervisors know why they are going away for 5 minutes every, they could be going to the loo. They could be getting a drink of water.
Smoke break.
Possibly. It could be anything like that. But if that is the reason why someone is saying, you're trying to force your religion upon me by taking a break that is, well, legally guaranteed to you by law.
Well, this is Virginia, right? So I don't know what their labor laws are like there.
Yeah. Just give me a moment when I completely reformulate my entire argument to accommodate for Virginia.
Well, I think that the accommodation here really is something that seemingly should be completely fine. There, as you said, Nick, there's folks that, you know, need to go to the restroom and 5 minutes, they would not be missed, or need to take a personal phone call for 5 minutes, or have a smoke break for 5 minutes, and to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to voluntarily cut my 90-minute lunch break. Also, 90 minutes. Where,
right. I want to work there.
Yeah.
That's three of my lunch breaks.
You know, you are voluntarily saying, I'm going to comp that time and make up all of my other breaks by shortening my lunch break. This is a woman who's proactively informing her prospective employer that she's going to not just be, you know, taking a break and texting or updating Instagram or smoking. She's saying, this is what I'm using those breaks for, and I'm going to make good on it by shortening my lunch break. And at that point, you end the interview and say, I don't want to deal with your religious shenanigans. That to me seems like there's a real reason for her suit. On the other hand, we see that there was an EEOC complaint that was apparently investigated, and they said they found no wrongdoing.
In my experience, those aren't necessarily super effective.
So perhaps we might be looking at this lawsuit prompting an audit of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to say, well, you found there was no wrongdoing, yet here are the places where perhaps this was a reasonable accommodation. And you know what? As an atheist, there's a lot of things that I grok at that really, you know, get under my skin about saying, I need to do this because of Jesus, or I need to do this because of, you know, XYZ. But at the same time, I'm very committed to a pluralistic society, and it's not going to harm me to have a colleague that is going to take 5 minutes to go and do her prayer according to what her faith is. In fact, I have Muslim colleagues, I've had Muslim students, and it wasn't until I was completely aware and looking for things that I noticed that they took their 5 minute breaks for those purposes. It was so discreet, and many, many, many American Muslims do this kind of thing. There's many, many Christian folks that will silently offer prayer before right. they eat meals in the break room, and you hardly even notice that.
Totally okay. Totally okay. I've had to sit in a room, in a break room, while a bunch of people had a prayer meeting. I was trying to have a nap, so it was annoying, but it was their right.
Okay,
It was my right to have a nap in the room at the same time.
All right, so those are those kinds of things that it's like, we're accommodating that, as long as they're not making it like a hostile work
right.
environment,
no,
where they're
bad.
Saying, don't nap in the Lord of Jesus,
no,
in
they
the
were,
name
they
of
were,
Jesus.
They were being super nice. They were okay. just trying to save everybody, and, you know, as the nice Christians do, just doing their thing.
Okay, so like no proselytizing in the break room where they're making it uncomfortable for you.
No, no.
They're just doing their own thing.
They're doing their own thing.
Okay.
Just loudly. So another point. So the guy actually pointed at her hijab and said, well, I don't want your kind here, basically.
Yeah, saying religious shenanigans. That's not shenanigans. That's like a cultural signifier.
That's like wearing a cross to a job interview. It's the same idea.
Those are the kinds of things that, as an atheist, I do want to stick up for religious individuals and my colleagues and my fellow residents and citizens, because, hey, separation of church and state protects all of us in those situations. It protects my right to not be proselytized too.
And it's also just the whole, if it makes you happy and it doesn't hurt anyone or affect anyone else that you're around, that's, it's completely fine. As if I was this person's supervisor, like, go ahead. As long as your production's good and you don't affect the productivity of your employees, Yahtzee.
Yeah, but this guy didn't like Muslims, apparently.
Well, and the sky is blue.
Well, we'll see how that shakes out. But in the meantime, I've got a question. It's from Mikey from Connecticut, and he asks, science has not found any evidence that a god exists, but it also has not found any evidence that a god doesn't exist. Therefore, wouldn't it be just as much a leap of faith to assert that there is no god as it would be to assert that there is? Wouldn't both claims be inconsistent with the scientific method? Nick.
Science has not proven that I do not have a unicorn in deep space that makes everyone happy and sparkly.
Oh my goodness.
Checkmate, Mikey.
One upping Bertrand Russell in his teapot. Ooh, sparkly unicorn. Luke, what about you?
I was going to go with more like, Nick is God, prove me wrong.
I thought we weren't going to discuss that today.
Shoot. Oh no.
So
what have I done?
What I look at here is, I don't know if Mikey is a religious believer or not. To me, Mikey strikes me as perhaps an agnostic that has disdain for what he believes atheists to be and what he believes religious people to be, saying it's just as much a leap of faith to say God exists as to say God doesn't exist. And so, ha, you can't actually be an atheist because you have faith. Well, here's the thing, Mikey. Atheists don't have faith that a god doesn't exist. We've come to the conclusion, and our practices reflect that we don't believe that a god exists, but we, when we look at it, we are so grounded in the fact that we are also agnostic. On the question of whether a god exists, we admit that we do not have knowledge of that, and we admit that the scientific method cannot address that kind of question. And so our atheism stems from what kind of conclusion we brought to. It's okay to be both an agnostic and an atheist, and in fact, many people are. I would venture to say that many believers are also agnostic, and that's the very reason that you have faith to begin with.
Well, I mean, how many gods don't they believe in on top of the one they do?
Oh, good point. Checkmate Mikey from Luke. Any more chess moves that we have?
This is something that I actually had several small arguments with my mom in my early 20s. She said, "Well, you're an atheist? I thought you said you were agnostic." Like, "Well, yes. Well, which one is it?" Well, I have green eyes and brown hair. Yeah. It's possible to be both.
They're not mutually exclusive
exactly.
At all.
Exactly. One is a statement of knowledge, another one is a statement of belief.
Well, if you would like to ask an atheist or an agnostic any particular thing, you can email us at questions@atheist.radio. Hear all of our episodes, past and present, at atheist.radio. Email us, give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at AskAnAtheistWA. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
And thank you, Nick.
You're welcome.
See you guys next week.